Hey Josh, thanks for coming on the Crypto Rabbit Hole. Great to have you here.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
So just for a bit of background, my reason for starting the Crypto Rabbit Hole was to promote crypto and financial literacy among kids my age, just because I feel like it's something that isn't really taught enough to, my demographic. So before we get started, Josh, can you do you mind telling us a little bit about your background and the kind of stuff you do over at Hedgeye?
Yeah, happy to do that. Yeah, so let's see. I've been working on Wall Street for a little over 22 years. I was an undergrad economics major. Frankly, wasn't really sure what you were supposed to do with an economics degree. Fortunately, a friend of mine in school got me or helped get me an internship with a retail broker. My junior year in college. And I thought the investment world was fascinating. I guess like yourself, I sort of went down my own rabbit hole and ended up working at a technology investment bank out of school and started out covering well, software and then the communications sector, satellite communications. And then moved over to covering financials, specialty finance, the housing space. And I've been doing that for a long time. I've worked at big firms like Lehman Brothers and hedge funds like Millennium Partners. And I've been at my current firm, Hedgeye, now for about 12 years. So we cover a lot. We cover financials, housing, macro, crypto. So yeah, we have a lot of different focuses and disciplines, but yeah, happy to do this conversation today.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate it. I'm really excited for this. So how'd you get into crypto specifically?
Yeah, so I guess if I'm being brutally honest, it took me a long time to sort of come around to crypto. I think one of my favorite quotes that I've heard out there is something along the lines of, you get Bitcoin at the price you deserve, meaning that once you sort of figure it out, you realize what it is. And I think for a long time, I sort of, was generally dismissive. I sort of thought it was, internet money, and I really never took the time to sort of get into it. And then what sort of started things off for me was that earlier this year, there was sort of this moment where there was this confluence of companies, between MassMutual, what they were doing, Bank of New York Mellon, Visa, MasterCard, of course, Tesla, Square. And it occurred to me, I just sort of noticed that all these companies were suddenly getting involved either directly or indirectly in Bitcoin. And I thought to myself, I must obviously be missing something here. And that was really the beginning of what became really sort of a journey or an odyssey that's still ongoing today. So, I'd say in the, 8, 9, 10 months or so since then, I've probably spent several hundred hours kind of going through a lot of different things and just reading, listening, watching. And yeah, the more time I spend on it, the more interested I get, the more I realize, of course, what I don't know. So yeah, that's sort of the background there. And at this point, it's very clear to me, I'm sure we'll talk about this more later, but it's very clear to me that this is, no longer an asset class at risk of going away. It's, increasingly becoming an institutionalized asset class. It's here to stay. And obviously, the growth rate is tremendous. I was looking last night at the shareholder letter from Coinbase. They reported their third quarter earnings, and they have a chart in there that overlays the adoption rate of crypto against the adoption rate of the internet. And what's interesting is that the number of users of crypto today, around 200 million, is roughly on par with where the internet was at the end of 1997.
Wow.
So if you think about, you know, the 24 years or so since then, obviously the amount of growth in the internet has been just staggering. So, you know, so long story short, you know, crypto appears very real, doesn't appear to be going away, and is poised to be, you know, an extraordinary growth sort of remodeling of a lot of the things that we sort of think about when we think about opportunities in the economy at large. So, yeah, so that's sort of the background and how we got here.
I mean, I'm sure for all of our sakes, I hope it does reach the level the internet has. But so just to start this off at, you know, 30,000 feet. So I'm no economics expert, but all the headlines in the news recently have been talking about inflation and massive government spending. So why should young adults who, you know, seemingly are pretty far away from that, from these complex issues, why should we actually care about these trends and take note of them? Like, how does it affect the money we all have saved in our bank accounts?
Yeah, it's probably maybe the most important question. I think the best way to sort of think about this is actually to understand it from a framework standpoint. And, you know, the best synopsis I've ever come across was written about 300 years ago by a merchant banker named Richard Cantillon. And basically what he wrote is this. He said, when it comes to money printing, which is where inflation comes from, three things happen as a result, and they happen in a specific sequence. The first thing that happens is that asset prices go up. So when you print money, asset prices go up. So why is that? Well, back then, you know, 300 years ago, it was really a function of how close you were to the king that determined how much you benefited from the printing of money. So if you were very close to the king, you were able to take advantage of the money. And the first thing you did with it was you bought hard assets. So in those days, you bought land. There were some equities, not many. There was the Mississippi Company and the South Sea Company and so forth. But for the most part, you bought land. So asset prices go up very, very quickly after money is printed. Then on a lag, anywhere from several months to a year or more, you would see the second thing that would happen as a result of money printing. And that was broad-based price inflation. And that's sort of where we're at today. So, you know, if you sort of think about when the money printing began, well, first of all, we've been printing a lot of money for a long time, especially post-2008, post the financial crisis. But that really went into sort of overdrive over the last 20 months. So to put it in perspective, in the last 20 months globally, we've printed $20 trillion. So the global money supply, M2, has risen by $20 trillion in the last 20 months. So that's taken it basically from $80 trillion to $100 trillion. So now about a year and a half into the pandemic, we're really seeing the effects from an inflation standpoint. So US CPI for October, actually just consumer price inflation, our consumer price index just came out for October this morning, up 6.2%. So that's the fastest rate of inflation growth in the US in over 30 years. And actually, if you look all around the world, you're really seeing the same thing. You're seeing it in Asia, you're seeing it in Germany, or rather in Europe, you're seeing it really everywhere. And so that's the second thing that happens when you print money. The third thing that happens, again, on a lag to the second thing, is you eventually and finally and lastly get wage inflation. So, you know, first asset prices go up, then the general price of everything goes up, and then much later, people's wages go up. But there's a catch. The amount by which wages go up is a lot less than the rise in prices and way less than the asset price inflation. So the reason, and this creates, this sort of perpetuates, you know, this sort of disequilibrium that makes it very, very hard for people who don't own assets to become owners of assets, right? Because asset prices are going up very quickly, as is the price of everything else. And then your wages are going up, but only by a little and on a lag. So think about somebody who's sort of starting out in life, somebody who's young and doesn't have a lot in the way of resources yet. Well, the cost of everything is going up, right? These are necessities, food, shelter, you know, clothing, transportation, you know, everyday consumer staples. And so they're spending more and more money on those. Meanwhile, so they have less and less disposable income. Meanwhile, the cost of things that are hard assets, notably like real estate, commodities, you know, we can talk about Bitcoin and crypto later, but anything that's basically a hard asset has gone way, way up. So if you look, for instance, at US home prices, they're up 20% year over year across the country. That's the fastest rate of growth ever. You know, if you look at equity prices, US stock market prices, the index levels are up over, you know, 100% year over year. That's the fastest rate of growth ever. So, you know, asset prices go up, then general inflation goes up, and then wages go up, but on a lag. And so, you know, the further downstream you are from that, like 300 years ago in Cantillon's day, you know, the people who were close to the king benefited the most, and the people who were furthest away from the king got harmed the most. And that's sort of a metaphor today to a degree for younger people. So yeah, you've got this structural problem that's created by the Fed, because they're the ones printing the money, that's making it harder and harder for young people to ever sort of catch up.
Yeah, I mean, so you talked about a little bit how people, mostly people in the higher classes closer to the king, would protect themselves from inflation with hard assets. And but you also talked about how, you know, a lot of assets during inflation, they the prices go up at a rate that's not proportional to, you know, the amount of money people are making. So how should people, especially younger people, think about investing their money in times like these? Like, where should people be looking to, you know, protect themselves from this?
Yeah, good question. So I think there are sort of like mainstream conventional answers, and then there are maybe answers that are a little bit less conventional. So I'll sort of address both. You know, the sort of go-to answer for this sort of thing is in the fixed income market, there are what are called TIPS, which are treasury inflation protected securities. So these are basically government-backed treasury securities that are linked to the general price level. And so if you're concerned that we're going to stay in a sort of highly inflationary environment for an extended period of time, you can buy these securities and they'll generally protect you against that inflation to a degree. You know, the catch is that you need to have an inflation rate that's above what's called the TIPS break-even rate in order for that to work out. And right now the TIPS break-even rate is already over 3%. I think that's a strategy that's probably not a great one for younger people. I think if you sort of move upstream, the next sort of conventional answer would be, you know, generally equities. So if you look at how equities perform in inflationary environments, it's really sort of a two-state system. And what I mean by that is when you have inflation that's sort of in the low to mid single digits, equities are generally a pretty good hedge against inflation. Once inflation gets into the mid single digits and higher, then equities, at least they have started to break down as an inflation hedge. So, you know, basically what ends up happening is there's sort of a threshold and above certain level becomes so extreme, pressure, and when earnings come under pressure, you see is multiple compression. And so, at least historically, that's generally been what's happened. Now, it's not sort of uniform across equities. So equities sort of fall into different sectors. So there are sort of nine what are called GICS level one equity sectors. And some of those sectors do better in high inflationary environments than others. So for instance, utilities and financials tend to be among the best performing sectors in high inflation periods. Consumer discretionary tends not to perform very well. A sector that's pretty much sort of, inflation agnostic is healthcare. So if you wanted to sort of lean in, so to speak, from an equity standpoint into inflation, you'd want to be looking at things like utilities and financials. I think moving out of the sort of, mainstream, I think the sort of other obvious hedges against inflation are really, basically hard assets. So real estate is the most significant one, right? So it's a $30 trillion asset class, U.S. residential real estate. That's certainly something that's going to hold up and usually actually perform at a slight premium to inflation. And again, going back to what we were saying earlier with the Cantillon effect, the more money that gets printed, the more rapidly that will find its way into hard assets like real estate. And then there's sort of other things going on, like for instance, you've got the whole sort of work from home dynamic that's been propagated by the pandemic and so forth. And there's a whole demographic element to it too, with younger people, millennials, sort of moving up into home buying age and so forth, but won't go into all that. But real estate is a very good inflation hedge, as are commodities generally, right? So anything that's priced in dollars, the definition of inflation is basically the value of the currency is going down. So anything priced in dollars is going to go up. So whether it's oil or precious metals or base metals, all these things tend to perform well in an inflationary environment. And then I guess the final thing would be if you wanted to move sort of further afield, then we could get into things like crypto, right? So we certainly talk about Bitcoin. Bitcoin's, in my mind, an extremely interesting inflationary hedge. But, we can probably talk about that later.
Okay, so earlier, you were talking about equities, and I think I lost you for a second just with the Wi-Fi for a few seconds at that point. So is there any chance you could just go into, what equities are and how they work, just for anyone who might be watching?
Sure. Yeah. Okay. So when you have publicly traded companies, as opposed to private companies, publicly traded companies issue equity, they issue stock, and that stock can be purchased by the public. And so basically what you're doing is you're buying an ownership stake in a company. And so really what we're talking about with equities is that you own a piece of a business. And so then the question with inflation becomes, well, how does that business perform fundamentally in an inflationary environment? Is inflation good for the business? Is it bad for the business? Is it neutral for the business? And I was giving sort of examples of different sectors of the economy, different business sectors that sort of some perform. So for instance, healthcare tends to be pretty neutral in an inflationary environment. Then at the other end of things, financial services, so banks, credit card companies, payments companies, that sector tends to perform quite well in an inflationary environment. And then as do utilities. And then at the other end of the spectrum, consumer discretionary, that category of businesses tends to perform poorly in an inflationary environment. And the reason is basically because that's where you have what's called a lot of elasticity of demand. In other words, people need to buy sort of core items, what are called staples, right? So you need to buy food to survive. You need shelter. You need transportation. You need clothing. These are all sort of core things that people need. But what ends up happening is the cost of those goes up a lot. the amount of money that's left over after from your income goes down. And so things that you would buy on a what's called a discretionary basis, things like taking a vacation, you have less money left over to do that. So those things, consumer discretionary things, tend to get hit in these inflationary environments.
Okay, perfect. So just before we steer the conversation towards crypto, I'd love to hear your just a quick explanation of, you know, what blockchain is. So can you give just a basic definition of what blockchain is, how it might be used in the future, and, you know, why some people see it as a revolutionary technology?
Yeah, sure. I'll do my best. So blockchain was really a technology that was sort of invented as a portion of Bitcoin. The idea was that basically by creating a block of information, in the case of Bitcoin, the block of information had to do with which wallets or private keys owned which Bitcoin or which Satoshis. And so what ends up happening is roughly every 10 minutes, a new block of information would get added to the prior block or prior chain of blocks. And so as you move forward in time, you get this, what becomes this immutable ledger, or in the case of Bitcoin, this record of transactions. So in other words, you know, all the way back to the very first block, the Genesis block, every transaction that's taken place, you can see it, it's open, it's visible to everyone who wants to take a look at it. And it's basically uncorruptible through proof of work, which sort of has its own designs to prevent basically, to prevent double spending, to prevent theft, to prevent the sort of any sort of corruption of the underlying blockchain. In other words, it's sort of this digital immutable ledger of the whole history of something from beginning to present. And blockchain, so it started with Bitcoin, but people realized within a few years or so that it could actually be used for other purposes as well. So Ethereum was one of the sort of early companies to come along and recognize this, Vitalik Buterin. And he sort of recognized that you could use blockchain technology really to create a decentralized architecture for a whole host of things. So right now, if we think about the way most sort of, you know, businesses are set up, they're all, or just about all, centralized structures, right? So whether it's, you know, the DTC that basically keeps records of all stock transactions, or, you know, Amazon, which obviously keeps records of all of its customer transactions and so forth. These are all central databases, Facebook, et cetera. And, you know, what blockchain makes possible is you have this decentralized network of computers that basically create this sort of centralized blockchain, but on a decentralized basis. And so, yeah, it enables this sort of completely different architecture than what's existed up until, you know, 2008. And I think we're sort of in early days of still figuring out all the things that blockchain makes possible. But the big takeaway is that when you have centralized systems, sort of by definition, you end up with what's effectively a middleman or a toll collector, right? And what's sort of interesting about decentralization is that you can basically eliminate that, at least to a degree. So I think that's what's so in here is that, you know, in my world, an analogy is that, this guy, John Bogle, created a company called Vanguard a long time ago, decades ago. And his whole idea was this. He said, if you look at the market overall, the performance of the market. And then you look at all the people who invest individually. Collectively, they represent the market, right? And then you look at all these mutual funds, and they, at the time, they used to charge much higher fees than they do today, but they would charge, you know, something like 2%. And so across, you know, all of them, they would basically, you know, replicate the performance of the market minus that 2% fee, right? They're the toll collector, the middleman. So he said, well, I'm going to create Vanguard, and all we're going to do is not try to beat the market. We're just going to try and replicate the market, and we're going to make our fees really low. And by doing that, we're going to beat like 90% of, you know, the other professional investors out there. And so he created this company, Vanguard, and it basically sort of gave rise to this whole category of investing now known as passive investing, where you're not trying to beat anything like active management does. You're just trying to minimize fees. And I think what decentralization and what blockchain does is it sort of creates a passive vehicle that lets you sort of sidestep these, you know, these toll collectors on any number of fronts. And so I think that's what's sort of remarkable about it.
Well, I mean, it's a very deep concept, I guess, and it's very interesting. So, I mean, there's so much to learn about. I've heard so many different aspects of it in what I've read. So anyway, just before, soon I want to move into, you know, Bitcoin, Ethereum, and, you know, more specific parts of crypto. But before we do that, just talking about crypto overall, do you personally, like, do you think it's the answer? Do you really believe it's the next great investment opportunity for our generation?
So, you know, the process for me was a process of sort of discovery. I think that my nature tends to be sort of more analytical, more mathematical. And as soon as I understood what Bitcoin was, how it works, you know, the sort of fundamental principles that govern it, right? So, you know, the mining reward halving every 210,000 blocks, you know, the sort of, you know, basically pre-programmed scarcity associated with it, obviously the decentralized nature of it, the difficulty adjustment that takes place every 2 weeks, you know, just the nature of the structure of it. It sort of had like an instant, you know, kind of like an aha type of moment where I realized, okay, this is clearly, you know, like very cleverly designed. And I think what to me is interesting about it is that, you know, if you sort of take a step back from it and you think about what it really is, it's a system and it's a design that is sort of genius, ingenious, and elegant in a lot of ways. But there is sort of another whole layer to it, which is that its conception was really sort of born out of a very profound awareness of the macro environment, which I think is really interesting. In other words, it's very rare that you would have that sort of cross-discipline sort of recognition, somebody who sort of simultaneously realizes the sort of fundamental, you know, not just limitations, but inequities, unfairness of the system, and then could actually have the technical ability to come up with a system that could effectively create an alternative. So I don't know if I would even call it rare, maybe it's just unique. So I sort of thought about it, understood it. I really became enamored with it. And, you know, again, the more I research, the more I learn about it, the more I find that I like about it. So yeah, there's a whole lot I like about it. There's really only a handful of things that I don't like about it so much. But I think those are things that are sort of being, you know, figured out and worked on. So yeah, I do definitely believe in it. From an investment standpoint, I think, you know, there are clearly risks. The risks are not insignificant, but I think the promise and the potential is such that, you know, you need to weigh that against the risks. And on balance, when you do that, I think the reward seems significantly in excess of the risk.
So we hear a lot about Bitcoin, right? People calling it the next great store of value, the next gold. So first of all, what is Bitcoin? And why do people think of it that way? Why are people so convinced that it's the next big thing?
Well, if you sort of take a step back and you think about gold and its history, you know, so basically money, right? What is money? Well, money is basically something you exchange for goods and services easily. And throughout most of history, money has been tethered back to some type of commodity. And, you know, the commodity most people are familiar with is gold, but there have been a lot of commodities over time. And the commonality of the commodities that have sort of used and served as money has basically been that there's been some degree of scarcity, right? They're hard to replicate. There's a famous example in the islands of Micronesia about 400 years ago. They used to use these giant stone wheels as money. And, you know, they're very hard to come by. You had to basically get in a canoe and travel hundreds of miles over open ocean. Again, this is like 400 years ago. And you had to mine these things out of a quarry on an island pretty far away, bring them all the way back to, you know, basically the island, which is known as Yap. And then, you know, you had your stone, and there were only a handful of stones on the whole island, and they were money because they were rare. And, you know, you couldn't just sort of like print them. And that system of money worked really well for actually hundreds of years until a guy came along and basically realized that he could mine a bunch of these stones to sort of, there's a whole sort of side story here. But basically brought all these stones to the island. And because all of a sudden all these stones came into the island, the value of the stones plummeted. And so the whole sort of monetary system collapsed. And I think what's interesting about gold is that it's, you know, been around for a long time. It's generally served as the backbone for money. You know, obviously as a country, the US was on a gold standard for a long time. Up until 1971. And so, you know, I think when you're sort of thinking about what is money, generally the idea is that, you know, money is something tied to something that can't just be replicated, you know, at will. And then that really changed in 1971, right? We came off the gold standard, and that was the introduction of fiat money. Right. So, you know, what is fiat money? Well, fiat money is basically, it's from the old, you know, Latin term, let it be done. Right. So, you know, a royal fiat, basically the king would say, you know, let it be done and it would be done. And, you know, the US government came along in 1971 and said, you know what, your money is no longer exchangeable for gold. Because prior to that, you could go into a bank and you could actually exchange your money for gold, your currency. And the US government basically said, let it be done. From this moment forward, currency will be, you know, worth a certain amount of value in terms of goods and services, right? And so I think that was kind of, you know, the moment when all of this sort of began, right? When we got us sort of this new path, this new journey, right? Roughly 50 years ago. Where, you know, the printing presses started running. And, you know, the thought with Bitcoin is really that it's sort of this, you know, modern day gold in the sense that it has a lot of the same principles, a lot of the same ideas. In other words, it's, you know, not something that can just be printed, right? There's a very orderly rate at which it's mined. We know what that is. We know the last Bitcoin will be mined not for about another 100 years. We know how many there are. It's very known. And what's sort of beautiful about it is that, you know, no government anywhere in the world can interfere with its path, its progression from a programming standpoint. And so it has this very, this known aspect to it. So I think that's one of the reasons it's sort of likened to digital gold. I think in terms of, you know, there's like a huge generational thing here, which, you know, most people struggle with a little bit. Basically anybody over the age of like either 40 or 45, certainly 50, I think for the most part has a really hard time understanding, you know, digital assets, Bitcoin, crypto in general. Under 30, I think people get it pretty easily. I think the best paper I've seen on this was just really like a blog post from Mark Cuban that he wrote at the beginning of the year called How the Store of Value Generation is Kicking Your Ass and You Don't Even Know It, basically explaining what digital assets are, why they have value, why they're really no different than sort of physical assets, provided that they have that ability to be non-fungible, right? And so, you know, so I think all of those things are sort of inherently, you know, transitive, transferable from sort of traditional concepts of money to, you know, what Bitcoin sort of represents. So I kind of leave it at that.
So, I mean, I think I personally agree that the comparison is clear. And I don't know if you'll be able to answer this, but do you ever see Bitcoin potentially surpassing gold as a store of value, or at least in the eyes of the public? Like, do you think people might ever trust it more than gold?
Well, there's a couple of things to sort of keep in mind. You know, the first is that there is sort of a precedent for like a generational asset class preference. So if you go back and look sort of through history, you know, we go all the way back to like the silent generation, the generation before the baby boomer generation, they preferred gold. That was their asset class. And if you look at the price of gold during that time frame, it performed extremely well. Then came the baby boomers, and they were really the first generation that embraced equities as an asset class over gold. And you can see and they were also the largest generation ever at that point in time. And so equities, you know, responded in kind. And then Generation X came along, and Generation X sort of followed in boomers' footsteps and also had a preference for equities, but it was a much smaller generation. And now you've got millennials. And millennials are interesting because they're the first sort of native digital generation. And there is a massive, massive number of them. There's like 90 to 95 million millennials versus around 65 million Generation X. And what you find when you sort of look into sort of life cycles and demographics is that between the ages of 35 and 45, that's when people have their largest increase in income. And so that transition from being 35 to 45, by the time you get to 45, you have a tremendous amount of disposable income, much of which goes toward investment. And so if you think about millennials, the oldest millennials right now are 37. The youngest is like 18 or 19. And so they're just at that sort of leading edge of when they're, you know, over this next decade, going to be moving up into this sort of, you know, peak spend, peak disposable income point in their life. So now you think about it in demographic terms, which is, you know, like a glacier. It moves very slowly, but it's very powerful. And over the next 15 or 20 years, that generation, the millennials, are going to sort of move through that investment point in their life and they're going to buy a lot of digital assets. So there was some survey work I saw earlier this year, and they found that just 3% of baby boomers own any digital assets. For Gen X, it's 13%, and for millennials, it's 19%. So clearly, you know, the younger you get, the more comfort there is owning digital assets. So I think that's an important thing to keep in mind, is that there's a huge demographic component to all this. So, you know, could it be bigger than gold? So right now, gold is, you know, a $10, $11, $12 trillion asset class. You know, I think, you know, if you think of Bitcoin right now, it's worth a little over $1 trillion. So, you know, roughly 1/10, let's call it, of what gold is. But again, you know, it, in my mind, has a lot of those same principles that gold has. It has enforced scarcity. It, you know, is secure. You know what the path is going to be over the next 100 years. And so I think it has sort of all those sort of hallmarks and tenets needed to be thought of as a gold substitution. And as the younger generation ages up and has more money to throw at things, you know, like in securities, price gets set on the margin, right? It's the marginal buyer who determines the new price of something. And so as you have all these younger people coming in and electing to take their disposable income and buy Bitcoin or digital assets, as opposed to gold, right? You can sort of see where that's going to go. But I think there's sort of a more profound question here, which is that really all Bitcoin is? Is it a store of value alone, or is it something sort of more than that? And, you know, in the course of going through a lot of different content on Bitcoin, I think the most interesting, certainly one of the most interesting ideas that I've come across is this idea that, you know, Bitcoin, I think I heard somebody refer to it basically as sort of an invention. It's like an idea. And that's sort of what I think is somewhat remarkable about it, is that, you know, like if you take a step back, like we hosted a call at a firm recently where the author of the book was talking about how you have basically secular deflationary forces brought about by technology. And that's sort of a long-term force. Right. So technology basically makes things less expensive. And on the other side of that, think of it as a tug of war. You have central banks printing money. Right. They're trying to create inflation. So you have these two things sort of in competition with each other. Sort of where we're at today is that the central banks are winning because remember, they can print as much money as they want. And they're always going to try and outpace that secular deflation brought on by technology. But there's a lot of arguments, strong ones, that deflation wouldn't be such a bad thing. And that's really what Bitcoin sort of represents. In other words, the idea is that over time, everything gets less expensive in priced in Bitcoin. And so that I think is a pretty radical concept. And when you start to sort of wrap your head around that, you realize that, you know, Bitcoin isn't just a gold replacement. I think it's more like almost like an alternative, you know, existence in a way. It's like you can basically unplug from the current system to a degree and plug into a completely different system. And you know, all these things we were talking about at the beginning with the Cantillon effect and how it basically disenfranchises younger people, right? Because asset prices just sort of keep, you know, think of yourself as somebody who's running like, you know, as fast as you can possibly run at whatever, 12, 13, 14 miles an hour on a treadmill. Well, the problem is asset prices are, you know, running away from you at like 20 miles an hour. And how are you going to keep up? How are you not just keep up? How are you going to catch up? And that's sort of what Bitcoin represents, is this opportunity to, you know, potentially play outpace money printing and actually have everything else that's priced in dollars or priced in Bitcoin basically become less expensive as opposed to more expensive?
I mean, this was also my next question, but you kind of touched on it already. So Ethereum is, which we're going to talk about in a second, is usually seen as more like the dollar compared to Bitcoin's gold. Like it has more, you know, practical uses. So do you see Bitcoin really having everyday uses outside of just a store of value or an investment? Like will we ever be paying for stuff in Bitcoin, do you think?
Yeah, I think, you know, the reason I think most people think of Bitcoin as primarily a store of value is because it wasn't originally, designed as a layer one solution to be a very effective medium of exchange, right? So it's capped at roughly 7 transactions per second, which would be nowhere near what you would need to run basically a global monetary system. So that was sort of the limitation. And, you know, the store of value, I think, sort of grew on the back of that limitation as its sort of primary purpose and use. Is becoming increasing is that our example would be the way the Lightning system works, which is a layer two system that sits on top of Bitcoin that scales up dramatically the sort of usability of Bitcoin as a global monetary system, right? So that's sort of an example where you're overcoming that limitation. And then I think, you know, you can sort of extrapolate beyond that, and you can sort of think about a lot of, so basically Ethereum arose partly as a function of the limitations of Bitcoin in its earlier days. But I think now, you know, we're at a point where there's a lot of creativity and thought going into how to facilitate those same capabilities through Bitcoin. I do think that Bitcoin certainly has the opportunity to sort of, you know, pull all of that back in away from Ethereum. But that's certainly not to say that Ethereum cannot or will not be successful in its own right. I mean, you know, things to remember here are that, you know, network effects play an enormous role in ultimate success and outcome. And, you know, the growth rate of, you know, what's happening on the Ethereum network is pretty staggering in its own right, right? So the number of developers, the pace of development, there's no greater network that's being developed at a faster rate than Ethereum. To give you a couple examples. So if you think of, there are a lot of different applications of Ethereum, but a couple of the bigger ones would be like DeFi and NFTs. And if you look at the DeFi network, so DeFi basically is a contraction of decentralized finance. And the idea with DeFi is basically the creation of almost what you could think of as a parallel financial system to the one that we're sort of used to today, right? So think of banking, right? You know, basically depositing money, borrowing money, trading securities, derivatives, all these things are possible and already exist in varying forms in DeFi protocols. And so one measure of the sort of speed of growth is through this sort of measure called TVL, which is total value locked. And I wrote about this back in June, but to put some numbers on it, because it's pretty staggering, the amount of TVL back in June was around $50 billion. So that might sound like a lot of money, but it's actually like a drop in the bucket of the global financial system. What is remarkable about it is that was up from about $1 billion the year before. So it had grown like 50-fold in 1 year. And if you went back just 4 years, the total amount of TVL was $4. right? So it went from $4 to a couple of years later to $1 billion. As of June this year, or May this year, it was at $50 billion. And I just looked at the number for October, and it was $112 billion. So it had more than doubled from June to October. So like the DeFi space is growing incredibly rapidly. And that's really in spite of this sort of rise of, you know, would-be regulatory headwinds to the sector. Then on the NFT side, that's like a whole other protocol that is, you know, made very easy by Ethereum. And to put some numbers on that, I was looking at one of the big NFT exchange platforms, OpenSea. And here's some numbers on OpenSea. So back in May of this year, OpenSea processed 138 million in transaction volume for the month of May. The year before, it was $1 million. So it went from $1 million to 138 million. I just looked at the October numbers. The October numbers were 2.6 billion. So again, the pace of growth, like, I don't know, it might be hard to contextualize this or even have a frame of reference for this because, you know, younger people, like most businesses, right? You know, if you had a company that's growing like in the high single digits or low double digits, like 8, 9, 10, 11, 12%, that's a pretty good rate of growth. That's per year, right? So when I throw out numbers like growing 100-fold, right, year over year, like that's just almost hard to like, it's mind-boggling the pace of growth that's taking place across DeFi and across NFTs. And these are two of the big applications of Ethereum, among others. So yeah, I think Ethereum is sort of growing so quickly that there are, in my mind, are questions about whether Bitcoin will ever be able to sort of almost like pull that back. In other words, you know, it's like the old, you know, Betamax, VHS, you know, dynamic in the 1970s where, you know, Betamax was sort of like this, you know, superior product, but VHS kind of got out there more quickly and ultimately, you know, cornered the market for the next 20 years. So we'll see. We'll see. I definitely think there's a pretty good probability that Ethereum is not going away. If anything, it's just going to get much, much bigger. But I do see, you know, a non-zero risk that ultimately Bitcoin becomes sort of this black hole that kind of pulls everything into it. So that's sort of the way I think about things, at least at the moment.
So, I mean, Josh, I should thank you because you just answered parts of like my next three questions. So I'm just going a little bit more specifically into Ethereum though. So what exactly is it, just for, you know, anyone who might want to learn more about it, and what makes it different from Bitcoin?
Yeah, so the basic idea is, well, maybe the easiest way to think about it is that, you know, when Bitcoin was created, it was fairly simple in nature. In other words, it was really designed to do like a very specific thing. And there wasn't a tremendous amount of flexibility, or really much flexibility at all, with doing things sort of above and beyond that. So it was sort of what's referred to as this Turing incomplete, you know, solution. So Ethereum came along, and it basically created essentially a computer language, Solidity, which enables you to create what are called smart contracts. And so smart contracts are, you know, basically, you can think of it as like, what's a contract? Basically, a contract is a legal agreement with sort of an a then, right? So if you do this, then I'll do that. And it's an agreement, it's a contract, legally enforceable. And so what these smart contracts enable is really this sort of automation of a lot of things that don't need any oversight, right? They can just run autonomously by themselves. And so this has a lot of applicability in things like finance, right? Where you don't need this sort of central control system to basically oversee everything, right? These contracts can basically run it by themselves. You know, and then, so really what Ethereum is sort of the, you know, backbone, basically the platform of what is going to become, you know, a lot of different things. You know, some people sort of call it like Internet 3.0, right? Where, you know, if you think of businesses right now, like Facebook or whatever, you know, or Google, right? Think about how those businesses operate. They basically get paid by, you know, stealing your data, you know, your personal information, and selling it to companies so that they can sell you stuff. And you, the user, really don't get anything for that, right? Like, I guess you could argue that, you know, you get to go on Facebook and see pictures of your friends and what people are talking about and read articles about, you know, what political group you should join, what militia. But, you know, in Google, obviously, search is tremendously valuable. But, you know, you kind of make a deal with the devil when you use these businesses. And most people don't really fully appreciate that. And so the idea, just to make it maybe more tangible for people, with Ethereum is that you could sort of cut those companies out of the loop, so to speak. And you, the individual, if you wanted to, could basically sort of monetize, you know, you could actually make money from your own data if you wanted to, right? So that's like something that would become possible. And, you know, like the founder of Square, who also founded Twitter, Jack Dorsey, has talked about this. He said, you know, the problem with the internet is that there was never a native digital currency when it was initially developed. And so as a result, you had all these companies create these business models that are like inherently unfriendly to people, right? And that was sort of the problem. And so the idea is that, you know, if you have Bitcoin or you have Ethereum, you can almost remodel the internet in a way that would be more sort of like, you know, almost like, you know, humane in a way. It would just be a completely different sort of approach to what's been built so far and how we think of it today. And that's really what Ethereum makes possible is, you know, this sort of this remodeling. So I think it's super interesting. You know, that's maybe not the best explanation of what Ethereum is and how it works, but I think that's sort of like the practical takeaway of what it could make possible.
Yeah, totally. So obviously referring to Bitcoin and Ethereum, which of the two are you betting on over the next few years?
So the way that I think about it, so the short answer is both. The way that I think about it is this. To come back to what we talked about earlier, which is, again, from this Coinbase shareholder letter I was looking at yesterday, you know, so where we are in crypto today is somewhere circa 1997, 1998 with the internet, right? Based on the adoption curve, based on the number of users, 200 million or so today, based on the percentage of the global population using it, which is around 2.5% of people. And so, you know, you take a step back and you think, well, you know, if I could go back in time to 1997, knowing, you know, then what I know today, what would I do? Well, I think most people would basically buy the companies that ultimately like the dominant engines of the internet, right? So the oldest of those companies would be Amazon. And then several years later, you had Google come along. And then sometime after that, you had Facebook come along and so forth. And then you know, you had obviously other large tech companies that sort of predated all that, that became very successful in their own right, Apple, Microsoft, and so forth. But I think when I think about the crypto universe, there's really sort of three elements to it. One is Bitcoin. The second is Ethereum. And then the third is everything else. And my framework for thinking about this is that in 20 years' time, I'm very confident that Bitcoin and Ethereum are going to be an extremely large share of whatever this industry becomes. So it's a $2-3 trillion industry in 20 years. Could it be a $20 trillion industry? Could it be a $100 trillion industry? You know, those are all possibilities. But whatever the answer is, I'm confident that Bitcoin and Ethereum are going to represent a very large share of that ultimate market. You know, so to me, it seems like it makes sense to bet on those two horses from an investment standpoint. And then the third wheel is, like I said, everything else. And that's where I think you take, you're already taking a fair amount of risk with Bitcoin and Ethereum for sure. But I think, you know, the probabilistic outcome is that they're both going to do well. I think, you know, if you wanted to get much more speculative, then you could range further afield outside of Bitcoin, outside of Ethereum. There's thousands of different options out there outside of those two, but they all carry very, very high degrees of risk, very speculative in nature. I was telling a friend yesterday that I was looking at the Shiba Inu coin, right? So the Dogecoin was like a joke on crypto in general. Like the guy designed it in a few hours and it was meant to be a parody. And the Shiba Inu coin was like a parody of the Dogecoin. And if you had invested $100, I use invest, the term invest lightly here. If you had speculated $100 in August of last year on Shiba Inu, today it'd be worth about $200 million. Yeah. So that's pretty incredible. But obviously the idea that you could buy a joke coin predicated on a joke coin, you know, and in a year, you could increase your money from $100 to $200 million. I think the odds of that are like, I don't know, maybe one in 100 million. So it's not like a high probability type of thing. But yeah, if you wanted to, you know, take flyers, there are interesting projects out there, right? So no question about that. And it's, you know, and again, like we can take lessons from the way the internet has evolved over the last 20 years, right? It's not like the only two companies that were successful were Amazon and Google. There have been, you know, a lot of, you know, 800-pound gorilla type companies, you know, half a dozen or so that have become wildly successful, like trillion plus dollar valuations, as well as, you know, dozens, if not hundreds of, you know, quite successful companies in their own right. And I don't think crypto will be dissimilar, right? I think there'll be a lot of projects that are useful and have applications that ultimately make it worthwhile that they exist, for sure. But as far as, you know, if you're making, like if you're gonna, you know, go into a time capsule for the next 10 or 20 years, you know, I would put money on Bitcoin, I would put money on Ethereum, and I'd feel pretty comfortable that if I were to, you know, go to sleep for 10 or 20 years and wake up, that that would have worked out pretty well.
I really hope you're right. So, I mean, I thought that was really interesting what you just said. I've never really heard anyone say it that way. Just to clarify, are you basically saying that, you know, you see Bitcoin and Ethereum as the two major players? And then with all these other, you know, with the universe of other coins that exist, there's bound to be some other, you know, There's definitely some value in the other options out there. Like they might not ever get to that level, but there's definitely it's not just a two coin game, essentially.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think, it's hard to imagine that with all the projects going on that, you know, not one of them, let alone, you know, half a dozen or, you know, even a few hundred potentially could ultimately have staying power, right? But again, from sort of a probability standpoint, you know, like think of it this way. If you went back to 1998, Amazon at that time was trading at, you know, on a sort of basis, something like $60 or $70 a share. So today, Amazon's trading around $3,500 per share. So even though you had missed, you know, the first 4 or 5 years of Amazon's life, you know, I think it was founded in 1994, you basically had like a 50x on the next 20 years. And I think when I think of, you know, Bitcoin or Ethereum, and the fact that, you know, crypto is on this sort of similar adoption curve to the internet, that to me is sort of the opportunity in those coins. These other companies are much smaller, much riskier, much more speculative. So they might have a lot more upside, but the chance that they're going to go to zero is also very high. So that's what you have to sort of appreciate and understand.
Okay. Yeah. No, that makes sense. So, I mean, I hate to say, but I think we're running a little low on time. So, you know, just before we wrap up, to learn about you and your company, Hedgeye, where can people go just to learn more about it?
Yeah, so our company deals with both institutional investors and individual investors. And the website is hedgeye.com. So hedge is in hedge fund, hedgeye.com. And there's a lot of information there. One of the things we really try to do actually is a lot of education. So we try to teach people. We have a very different framework for thinking about investing, thinking about the world, than most of what else is out there. So, and, you know, based on our success over these last 12 years and the rate of our own growth, I think our framework makes a lot of sense to a lot of people. So anybody wants to check it out, they can go to our website. We also have, you know, between the different, you know, senior people at the firm on Twitter, something like, I don't know, 500,000 Twitter followers. So there's lots of different ways, pretty easy to check us out and learn more about us.
Yeah, totally. No, I encourage all you guys watching to definitely do that. So Josh, thank you so much. It was really great having you on and I really appreciate your time.
Awesome. Thanks a lot, Alex. Been a pleasure and congratulations on the crypto rabbit hole. Sounds like a really good project.
Of course. Thank you so much. So as always, make sure to subscribe to the Crypto Rabbit Hole on YouTube, to follow me on Twitter at @AP_rabbit hole. And of course, you can also find us at cryptorabbithole.net.